This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with David Cole. David, great talking to you again.
Always a pleasure. Always happy to be here.
And I'm also joined here with Matthew Pegas.
Hi, Robert. Good to be here as always.
So recently, Matthew and I went to David's event that he hosted. This was for Ann Coulter and her new book, Resistance is Futile, and this was in West L.A. And David, you organized the event.
Yeah, this was a fairly large undertaking. We had about 200 people there in West L.A., in the heart of what one might call enemy territory, but for me, a guy who had been part of Friends of Abe, the Hollywood conservative organization. I've been part of that since 2009. I know it's not all enemy territory. There's lots of us, lots of conservatives, lots of people on the right in the town. We just don't ever have these days with Friends of Abe having shut down. We don't have anything to do. So I brought everyone together. Very big event in a very large, nice ballroom on the west side. Ann Coulter, who's a friend of mine, who had me do several events with her and for her while she was out here in Southern California, because she does not get out here all that much. She had a great time, and the evening went exceptionally well, especially, I have to add, due to you guys, because the two of you were very helpful the entire night. Robert, Matt, you guys just bent over backwards to be helpful, and you were an integral part of making it work.
Definitely. We're glad we could help.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, really appreciate it.
Well, no, I mean, if I may give an example, Matt, I don't want to give give anything personal away, and I'm going to try not to. But me, in my old man ignorance, I was selling Ann Coulter's book, Resistance is Futile. I had a table set up. I had brought about 80 copies or so of her book there, about 70 or 80 copies. And it never even freaking occurred to me till I got there and set up and then the event started that not everybody wanted to pay with cash. And I didn't have any way to accept credit cards. And you, Matt, you're the one who's like, Venmo. I don't know this shit. You younger folk, you're the future. Me, I'm roadkill, burning up the highway there, getting eaten by buzzards. You helped me salvage selling Anne's book. A lot of people bought her book because of you and suggesting Venmo. That was so helpful. You were there, you did video duty, and you also really helped me out not losing money on all those books. Because one thing I found, normally, back when I was David Stein, and I would do these events a lot, normally these A-list authors their publishers would just give me stuff on consignment. And that's a little bit of the industry norm, is you get books on consignment, you sell what you can, you return what you can't. Everyone wins. The publisher makes the money from the books, and I'm not out money if I can't sell every single one of them. But Anne's publisher, Penguin, specifically Penguin's conservative arm, Sentinel, they don't do consignment. I found that out early on. I had to buy those books. Every book on that table was a book I had paid for. If it didn't sell, I'm stuck with it. Not that there's anything wrong with being stuck with an Ann Coulter book. All of her books are worthwhile to just give to people as gifts. But I'm just saying, as a man who is not, I'm not a wealthy man. I'm not, you know, I'm not a rich man. So that was a risk I took. And it would have come out so much worse. We pretty much sold almost every book. The number of books that were left, it was just a small handful. And all because of you guys. So I thank you guys. You were not just bystanders or attendees. You were participants, important participants in making the evening come off so well.
Can you talk about the background of your friendship with Coulter?
Sure. it's hard for me to say this without getting full of myself, because I love her work. She's just one of the best authors and best forces on the scene, forces of nature on the political scene during my lifetime. Just one of the very best. But about a year and a half ago, she let me know that she likes my work. She likes my Tacky Mag column. Then I sent her my book. She loved my book. And we became friends because of that. We became friends because of a mutual respect and admiration for each other's work. I consider her one of the best authors out there, one of the best political commentators out there. And she likes my work. It's very, it's humbling to me that she reached out to me and that we became friends that way, because I admire her so much and I think the world of her. And she's a joy to work with, not a diva, no prima donna. I've worked with those before. I've worked with people in my Stein years who were demanding and difficult to work with. She is a joy to work with and just a wonderful person, as funny and enjoyable as she comes off on TV. She's even better in private, one-on-one. She's just a wonderful person. I can't say enough about her. And she knew that my name is no longer Mud, but there's maybe 10% Mud. There is, on my 23andMe profile, I'd say about 10% of my DNA comes up as Mud. And I don't mean that. You know, I don't mean that. I know that's a loaded term, because, like, racists will use that term. You know, he looks like Mud. I don't mean that. I just mean name is Mud in terms of Dr. Mud, in terms of the way that term has always been used. About 10% of my DNA is still hated reject.
So are you able to mention the one of the attendees who had an issue with you?
Sure. Sure. Look, this was my first time doing one of these things in 5.5 years. I thought it went exceptionally well for the fact that it had been so long since I had done that. But there's always going to be an issue. There will always be a problem. Even back when I was doing these monthly, there were still problems. You can't avoid it. You have a couple hundred people and maybe 6 or 12 speakers. There's always going to be issues. And the main issue we encountered at this one, God love him, that conservative right-wing guerrilla street artist Sabo, who I knew from previously, working with him previously, I wanted to do an auction of his. He had brought a large poster, very large poster, I think, like a man-sized poster, like something like a 5 feet by 4 feet poster of one of his work, and I was going to auction it off. But here's where I miscalculated, and this is my fault. When I used to work with Friends of Abe, Gary Sinise, Kelsey Grammer, those guys, when your A-lister was done speaking, people would stay in their seats for the closure. Gary Sinise would come up and would say, "So it was a great night. We have books for sale over there. And God bless our troops serving abroad, and the and let's make sure that we stay together." And he would just give his little spiel at the end. I didn't realize that, because I introduced Ann Coulter, that's when I should have made certain announcements. The reason I didn't make certain announcements, like the auction of the Sabo artwork, is that my respect for Ann Coulter is such that once she arrived, I'm going to bring her right on the stage. I'm not going to make her wait off stage like some rank amateur. I'm not going to do that. She deserves much better. So once she got there, when I brought her up, I brought her up immediately. And then I assumed that once, because the plan was, once she was done speaking, and she was great, gave a great speech, took questions from the audience, was very, very nice with everyone. And then we ushered her immediately to the VIP area to begin signing books for people to line up and get their books signed. I did not foresee, and again, this is just on me. This is entirely my fault, completely on me. I didn't foresee that once she was ushered to the VIP area, that everyone would get out of their fucking seats and rush over there. So I'm on the mic trying to be like, "Oh, and by the way, later on, going to be auctioning artwork by Sabo. Anyone? Is this on? Is this thing on?" No one gave a shit. They just wanted to be in line for Ann Coulter. So that, and again, that's my fault. That's not Sabo's fault. It is my fault. I should have made the announcement about the Sabo auction when everybody was rapt, waiting for Ann to come on. When the room was full, not a soul was at the bar, not a soul was in the bathroom. That's when I should have done it. Okay, you screw up. You make a mistake. That's a mistake I made. Sabo chose not to accept my apology and just roll with it. I'm not blaming him for that, because I made the mistake. When you're the guy who made the mistake, you don't blame other people for how they reacted to your mistake. I'm the one who made the mistake. So when nobody stuck around and we couldn't get a crowd for the auction, it's like because once people got their books signed, they headed to the bar. Whole different area, not where the tables and seats are. So when we couldn't get a crowd for the auction, let's just say Sabo was upset, is what we will say. Sabo was upset, and I'm not blaming him for that. I'm blaming myself, and I did my best to apologize to him, as did my plucky Irish assistant, Connor. Greatest guy I've ever worked with it as an assistant. We did our best, but Sabo left angry, and that happens.
So there's a lot of people you knew from Friends of Abe, and some people turned against you at your outing. Did you reconcile with those people, or did some of those people still have an issue with you over your past?
That was a choice that I was wrestling with in the weeks before the event, because I saw that certain people who I had issues with me had bought tickets, and I made the decision to just let the event happen because I had this young kid, Connor, handling far more of the scut work than I. Connor was the one doing emails. Connor was the one doing just working the room and being the guy to shake hands. So I figured I'm just going to let the chips fall where they will. There were only a couple of instances of momentary bad feelings. One guy in particular, I'm not going to say his name because we reconciled that night. One gentleman in particular, he comes in, I told Connor to comp him because I knew there might be problems when he saw me there, and I didn't want to be accused of taking his money and then setting him up for something uncomfortable. So this guy was comped. He had paid nothing. He did not have to pay the entry price. So this guy comes in, comes up to the registration table where I happened to be standing at that time. And at first, he doesn't see me. He's like, hey, great, I'm here for the cold revenge. Oh, boy, what a great thing. And then he sees me, and he's like, oh, you. And I take him aside, and I say to him, I'm not going to say his name, let's say Joe. I say, Joe, how about we declare a truce for tonight? One night, we let bygones be bygones. And then the guy looks around. He sees how packed the room is. He knows that Ann Coulter's there. He doesn't want to miss this. So he looks at me and says, how about we make bygones be bygones forever? And I'm like, friend. He's like, friend. And we're fine. Because that cliche, it's a terrible cliche, but it's true. Nothing succeeds like success. When you do something well, when you pull it off well, people who might otherwise have problems will suddenly forget those problems, go along with you, be nice to you, because they see that you're doing something effective and positive. There had not been an event like this in LA since Friends of Abe folded. So this was, he recognized, and this gentleman, Joe, recognized this. And he immediately, his countenance changed. And the whole night, we just hugged and we were fine. There were two other people who privately expressed grievances to Connor, to my assistant. And, you know, fuck him. Screw him. I'm back. I'm doing this. If you're literally going to still be living in April 2013, well, God bless you. I can't stop. I can't stop.
Do you
stop
think
that
there's this dichotomy between the pre-Trump climate and the post-Trump climate?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. 100%. And there are a couple other names I can't name, but there were some fairly powerful political players there who are people who dabble, you know, who are complete Trumpers and also dabble a little bit in the alt-right. The climate has changed. With the way that the Overton window has been opened in the last couple of years, the idea that I'm radical at all, the idea that there's something, anything even remotely radical about me, it's just foolish. It's just stupid. And anyone who still wants to give me the stink eye, anyone who still wants to go on Facebook and say, I can't believe that Monster Cole was there. Well, you know, do it. I don't care. I pulled this off without any of those people. There were only two people in out of 200 who privately had a problem, but they stayed. The two people who privately expressed their displeasure, all the same, they fucking stayed. They did not walk out because they saw the size of the crowd and they saw that Ann Coulter was on my side and my friend. And so I'm never going to make 100% of this crowd like me again, but I don't give a shit. I don't care. It's the least of my concerns. So, you know, so be it. It's not going to inhibit anything that I do from this point on.
Yeah, it really seems, talking about like the Overton window shifting and pre-Trump and post-Trump, that there's a strong sense of that we need to kind of stick together, people who are pro the First Amendment, pro free speech. You know, maybe in 2013 there was still this sense of like, well, certain topics are completely off limits, but, you know, seeing what happened to with Roseanne, especially like in a Hollywood context, I think it's becoming really apparent that we can't play that's the less game, you know, to censor, and that we can be the people who don't do that. And I think that's I think that might be one of the single biggest things that has been kind of giving the Republican Party power in the
age of course. Trump. And I'll give you an even like a stronger example from my experience. Go back to 2012-2013. Friends of Abe, which controlled that mailing list, which I also have, and that's the mailing list I used. I didn't steal it. I didn't hack it. I had it because I was one of their organizers. So I'm the only other one other than Sinise and his people who have the mailing list. Back in 2012-2013, it was solidly neocon. Not the list, but the leadership. When you would come to one of these events, the general theme of every event was support the troops. Iraq was a great idea. Look, here's a guy who just got his balls blown off, but he's in a wheelchair. let's give a standing ovation
and,
to him.
You're obviously not a neocon, but you sort of had to. That was a climate at the time.
Oh, that was a climate at the time. Of course, that was. You had to comply with that. That was the group. They would bring in these veterans, some of them missing limbs, scarred, and one of the Friends of Abe leaders would get up and give a speech about it. And this young man, who is only 25, and he's got no legs, no balls, but he lost them for our freedom. Because if he had not lost his legs and balls in Baghdad, right now we'd all be speaking Arabic. Huh. And the crowd would be like, yay, ah, hooray, woohoo, woohoo. Conversely, if you said something like, Mexican immigrants are not all rocket scientists. They're not all coming here to send us to Mars. Out of the group you go. That is racist. Out of the group you go.
It's okay to antagonize another nationality if you're on the other side of the world, but when they immigrate here, you
when
have to
good
be...
economically,
so it's like that. Have you heard of that term Steve Saylor coined, invade the world, invite the world?
Right, of course, yeah. Yeah, and indeed, that's how it was. The Muslims that we were blowing up and our own people, our own boys who were getting dismembered and killed, you know, that's all great. But if you dare to say that maybe one out of X amount of Mexican immigrants might be a rapist or a criminal, well, that's it. You get expelled for that. That's racism. That's racism. So it was so solidly neocon that even expressing thoughts about something like affirmative action, saying that, do we have to add points to a brown person's test scores? That was not encouraged at all.
Well, even with Coulter, her affiliations have shifted, because I remember originally she was a strong supporter of the Iraq War. And I think she had different motives than George Bush, but she was sort of aligned more with that crowd, and now she has a much more nationalistic message, and I mean, I wouldn't call her alt-right, but maybe alt-light would be a more accurate characterization. So even with Ann Coulter's focus, she shifted from some sort of war and terror era back in the Bush era to now focusing on immigration. So she demonstrates the shift in the political scene.
And I think what she saw is what I saw, which, because this was all happening, her on the East Coast, me here on the West Coast, but it was all kind of happening at the same time. I'm not saying I give a shit about Iraq. I care about America. And I think I would never speak for Anne, but she would probably say something similar. It's not like she is going to pick up a flag and go and defend Iraq. I only defend this country. This is all I care about. And when the Iraq invasion first happened, there were some of us, again, I don't want to speak for her, but myself, where we were like, okay, this is some fetish of Bush's. Bush wants to do this. Let's get it over with. Topple Hussein and all the experts say that we'll put in a friendly government and it'll be hunky-dory. It'll be 1945 Japan 2.0, and we'll create a Western democracy, etc. Clearly that didn't happen, and then what ended up happening on the neocon wing was that as the Iraq war continued to fail, the neocons began insisting on fidelity to it at the expense of the stuff that some of us cared about, things like demographic change and immigration and just simple things like letting the best and the brightest, you know, of whatever race. I'm not talking about, you know, something as a purely racist policy. I'm just saying letting the best and the brightest in. And the neocons began actually working against that. So now they're demanding fidelity to a failed concept of this whole regime change, mission accomplished bullshit. Well, they failed. And they're demanding fidelity to it and also patrolling us to try to eliminate any of us who might want to be more obsessed with what is happening at the southern border.
And also
and
with
turned a lot of us against them.
Yeah, so you mean that whole thing, the invade the world, invite the world mentality. The other thing about neoconservatives is, as we're seeing with the left today and their alliance with big tech, the neocons were more in favor of censorship of dissident views than today's right-wing movement.
Yeah, that is, and that's the same arm of the neocons who used to patrol Friends of Abe looking to expel any racists. They would do, and I say racists in quotes because a lot of what they claim to be racist is not something that I claim to be racist. Obviously, we never had anyone in Friends of Abe who, you know, was like, black peoples is apes. Get them blacks out of the country. We didn't have that. We didn't have any ignorant, like, straight out KKK racists. Of course we didn't. We all would have kicked that guy out because that's not what the group was ever about. We never had that. But they would kick people out for simply talking about things like crime rate among third world immigrants and crime rate among minorities in big cities, things like that. So they align with the left and with the big tech companies because they themselves are fine with kicking out people who they see as quote-unquote racist.
Yeah, what I'll say about Coulter, too, is though she's very much a team player on the side of the Republicans and has been for her whole life. But even though she has maybe changed her focus a bit in the era of Trump, and in many ways is partly responsible for the shift, actually. So, as I understand it, Donald Trump read Adios America, that informed his campaign. But she's always had a very – I haven't read all of her work, but in books like Slander, she's always, I think, had a very good sense of kind of who the enemy is, perhaps. Maybe that's a little bit too bellicose a way of saying it, but – She's always been one of the best, I think, critics of the liberal media. So no matter what interest she's kind of talking
but she
about,
doesn't just,
her
basic
understanding has remained.
Yeah, she doesn't just criticize the left in a lot of her books and articles. She does criticize a sort of a Chamber of Commerce, Koch Brothers wing of the Republican Party.
Yeah,
Oh yeah, indeed. And she's able to criticize Trump, and he still follows her on Facebook, which is amazing. You know, that's... on Twitter. So that is true power in 2018, is that you can criticize Donald Trump and he doesn't drop you. He still follows you on Twitter. She's very influential. And people will bring up what she said right after 9/11, where she said we should invade their countries and convert their leaders. That was the same anger I was feeling. That was not some kind of cold political statement. That was having just witnessed 3,000 people immolated and murdered, and all of the women, children, and other people left fatherless, without husbands. I was feeling the same way in the weeks after 9/11. I fucking wanted to just go over there and clean house. I mean, if you had said to me, you know, would the world be better? Should we save Afghanistan, or, you know, just erase it? I'm like, what good has it ever done the fucking world? Erase it. But that was said in the heat of the moment. And if you can't cut people slack for reacting viscerally and emotionally to seeing 3,000 people killed, you know, everyone's, I mean, we do far less if a black guy gets killed and then some black columnist goes on CNN and says, white man of the devil, we should just ban white men. Well, okay, everybody gets slack if they feel, you know, if they're emotionally riled up by something. But what Ann Coulter said immediately after 9/11, that was very specific, very unique to that moment.
Oh yeah, for sure. And has there been any reactions to your friendship and ties with Coulter from Conservative Inc.?
There have, and I don't want to give away anything that she and I have talked about in private, but let's just say she's my friend. That doesn't change because of anything that she hears from a couple of people, and it's always going to dog me. I mean, I have to realize that is always going to dog me, and there's nothing I can do about it. There are always going to be people who are going to hold their impression of what I've written, because what they say I've written and my position was in the early 90s is not what it was. But there's always going to be people who hold that against me. I make this point a lot, guys, which is I've written more about the Holocaust in the last 5.5 years than I did during the entire decade of the 90s. I've written more since 2013 to the present than I did from 1990 until I left the scene, the revisionist scene, around 97. But everyone goes back and looks at the stuff from 1991 and 92 as though somehow that's where it ended. It's silly, it's foolish. Ann Coulter has read my book. She reads my column. She frequently tweets my column. Those are my views. I'm not saying that I contradict anything I said in the 90s, because I don't. But for fuck's sake, come on. You have a guy who has written a lot in the last 5.5 years, and the best you can do is go back and like pull one line from a live talk show from 1992. It's just silly.
And the thing is, the type of people who will attack either you or Coulter for that connection, they're like the kind of old guard establishment or the never Trumper crowd, but those people are becoming less and less relevant, and I think we're moving to a new era.
If Trump had lost, those people would be in charge now. If Trump had lost, then that old guard, the neocons, they would be running everything right now. But they're the ones who are marginalized at the moment, and they know it. They exercise their power when they can, and so in the case of seeing me at an event like this, running an event like this, that some of them are going to bitch, but again, so what? Need anything from them, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. I think a great example of that is National Review purged all their politically incorrect writers, and now they're relevant.
Exactly. A great point. A perfect point. They purged everyone Derbyshire and everyone who they felt was, oh, we can't have even a hint of racism. Not even a hint. Not even a hint. Ooh, we don't want to be racist. We don't want to be racist. And they did. They fucking relegated themselves to full irrelevancy. No one cares what they say anymore. Nobody looks to them to lead a story, to direct a story, to direct the spread of a story. They are completely irrelevant. And they did that to themselves by being little pussies. And somebody, oh, you said something about black people. Out you go. You Klansman. You're Bull Connor. You're worse than Bull Connor. These hysterical, we can't, if someone's skin is brown, we can't criticize them or criticize anything about a group of brown-skinned people. That's not the way of America right now. Right now, the left is as it has been for years and years. The left is going nuts with very specifically anti-white stuff. Stuff that is as racist as anything that has been on the national scene since the days when the Klan could still get op-eds put in newspapers. The right just wants a little bit of a chance to oppose that. The people I work with, they're not looking to be as bad as the left. They're looking to oppose the left. When the left says all whites are the worst terrorists ever, and whites are the source of all evil, and we just want to be able to oppose that. We just want to be able to have an opposing opinion. So when people ostensibly on the right, like the National Review crowd, when they're like, oh no, that's going too far, no, you know, let's have to let the left have their say, hey, maybe whites are the worst in the world, who are we to say? That's done. That's not the way anymore. That's just not the way that things are anymore. Now, obviously, a lot is going to change next Tuesday. We're one of the difficulties, like, for example, the column that I'm writing, that I will be writing this weekend, is a tricky one because I know that people will be reading it on Tuesday next week. So you can't say anything that is going to either be proven right or wrong that day. People, by the time they read it, a lot of them are going to know how the midterms have turned out. A lot is going to be dependent on that. Anne made the point in her speech that she believes we're going to definitely, that we being Republicans, are definitely going to keep the Senate and maybe even add a few seats, but the House is in play. I feel the same way. Precedent is that the House, that the president's party loses the House in his first midterm. We will see. What I will say is that if we keep the Senate, that's kind of all I care about, because that applies to Supreme Court nominees, and of course Trump can't be impeached with the Senate and not willing to. If we keep the House, that's going to be monumentous. That's going to be precedent-setting if Trump keeps the House. If we don't keep the House, well, Trump is at his best when he's on the campaign trail bitching about stuff.
In Coulter's speech, she did make the point, so she's actually been very critical on Twitter of Trump for not fulfilling his promises on immigration. She talks about the wall. What are your overall thoughts on Trump's performances on immigration? Has he fulfilled his promises, his goals, and is it his fault or is it other forces standing in his way?
Well, one area in which Anne has a different point of view than a lot of other Republicans is that she loves Jeff Sessions. She feels that Jeff Sessions is the only one taking the border seriously, the only one who is really concerned with enforcing the things that Trump ran on. Trump promised so much, and I agree with her, with Ann, that he's not delivered. Now, what's happening now with the caravan is forcing his hand. He's sending troops down there, and he has no choice. But, yeah, we should be working on the wall by now. We absolutely should be. Because he promised it. There was probably not a single more blatant, I'm going to do this first day in office promise than build the wall. And he hasn't. On the other hand, he is... him and Sessions together, they have been better on immigration than any Republican in recent memory, but it would look nice, it would look better if the wall was actually being built. But the caravan could be a godsend.
I personally think that he will eventually build the wall, just because I can't imagine him flaking that bad on a promise. I think he might not be able to, but I think he's not going to leave office without at least trying.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is that if he loses the House, the wall doesn't get built.
Yeah, no, that's clear.
I mean, that if he, the House has to give him the funding, and if the House isn't going to give him the funding, then, but then again, you know, he can then run in 2020 blaming the Democrats, and he likes doing that. But he did have, I feel, ample time last year, especially, even more than this year.
As far as your personal views on immigration goes, have you always been more of a stronger immigration restrictionist, or did you, when you were younger, were you more pro-immigration?
I've written about this several times in my column. I'm probably much softer on this issue than Anne is. Maybe it's growing up in L.A., and maybe it's being an upper-middle-class homeowner who uses Mexican labor a lot. And maybe it's just being a misanthrope. One of the things I like about Mexican labor is that when they work around my house, I can't understand a fucking word they're saying, so it's like white noise to me. It doesn't bother me. I've given the example before. The house next door to me, some people bought it, tore it down, rebuilt it. The whole process took a year. So the house that abuts my bedroom, the house that that is like closest to where I sleep, while they were tearing it down and rebuilding it, I noticed that initially it was all Mexicans doing the work, because the initial work was just tear down. You know, he sledgehammer, take sledgehammer at the wall, put sledgehammer in wall. And during that time, when it was all Mexicans, I slept fine, because that with their yammering, to me it sounds like mañana, 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 mañana. It's Spanish is a beautiful language, like French. These are two very beautiful Romance languages, and the sound of it. I've purposely never learned Spanish because I don't want to. I want to be shut off from that segment of my city, because it also gives me an excuse to not talk to people. You know, you go into a donut shop, señor, mañana, mañana, mañana. I'm like, no comprende. No, just give me my donut. I wish I could do the same with other people. That's not me being racist. I wish that I could just shut myself off from having to do small talk with whites and blacks as well. But then when the rebuilding of the house next door started and things got a little more complex, they're doing wiring now, they're doing gas lines, they're doing stuff that's a little more complicated. Now the white laborers come in, and I understand every fucking word they say, and I cannot sleep. It's 7 in the morning. I'm trying to sleep, and here's what I hear outside my window. You fucking dick! You got the wrong thing! Fuck you, man! That's the thing you told me to do! You fucked up the whole fucking thing now! And even when they're not arguing, they're trying to, like blue-collar, jive with each other. Like, hey, fuck your sister last night! Yeah, was her pussy good? You bet it was! Well, fuck you, man! You smell like my sister's pussy! And I can't sleep with that shit going. I preferred it when it was the Mexican workers, because then they, mañana, 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 I can't understand them, and I'm happier that way. But also, I want to make the point, go, because that's kind of very unique to me. The point I just made is very unique to Dave.
Well, do you acknowledge that you're biased coming, being an upper middle class homeowner, and that someone who's a working class person competing with them would have a totally different view?
Of course. No, of course. And I have several biases that are unique to me, or unique to where I am, my status. Me being an upper class homeowner, I love having the cheap labor, and I'll admit it. I love having the people I don't have to talk to, or listen to, or understand. But also, in the course of my work, back when I was Stein and I was doing mainstream films, I did quite a few films that put me in touch with what the media would call white Hispanics. That the upper class of Mexico, the ones who come here, and I welcome them. I have some of my very, very, very best friends from those days, including the girl I always used to consider my adopted little sister, because she would spend holidays with me and my family, and I would spend holidays with her and her family. These were the Mexicans who in Mexico had Mexican maids. These were the culture elite, the property owners. I want them to come here because they were some of the, in terms of some of them who were film financiers of mine, some of them who wrote movies, because I can't write Spanish, of course, and I would do movies for the Spanish language market, and I would work with them on that. So for me, I never want to discourage that really strong, bright, entrepreneurial element of Mexico. Mexico has some beautiful areas, and Mexico, there's parts of it that are a beautiful, beautiful country. The problem I have is with the people who come up, gang members spreading crime, and the people who want to come here illegally because they either don't want to take the time to do it the right way, or they have something in their past on the criminal record or something that is going to make that impossible. But it does not come down to race with me. It just comes down to, as an upper-class homeowner, I do like the free labor, but also as a Los Angelino, I like to live in an area, as I do, doesn't have any ghetto crime. So yeah, my perspective would be different if I was a young white person who came here to be an actor. And because of the insanely high cost of living in L.A., I'm forced to live in a not-so-good area. And so I've got to go to one of these – I got to go home to one of these not-so-good areas where every night, you know, guns being fired, arriba, arriba, and graffiti everywhere. Well, obviously, I'm going to get a different perspective that way.
Matt, do you want to comment on some of the aesthetics that we used in our footage that for both the intro and the outro of the, it's the mini mall in West LA. Yeah, it's very 80s.
Yeah, I guess we're not naming the location specifically, but I did think a nice aspect of the culture event and good thing to get on film was that it was a very sort of 80s style ballroom and conference center and I guess shopping complex as well. So it kind of matched. The event was obviously great to get on film, and that kind of even just the exteriors kind of match some of the aesthetics that we would apply into some of our films in the past. So that was another good aspect of it.
The venue was rented by me purely on two things: size, I had to accommodate about 200 people, and safety. Safety was the primary concern, and the venue was second floor with no direct street access and no windows. I had to expect the possibility of protesters showing up because it is Ann Coulter. So I chose the venue entirely for those two reasons, size and safety. It's a venue that is primarily used for weddings, and you can tell, wedding receptions, and you can totally tell that it's a place that is normally used for wedding receptions. But it's big, it's roomy, the sound system was good, the bartender was great, and but most importantly, it was it was safe, and we had some amazingly good security. And I do want
to. I was going to ask about the Proud Boys. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out because we had damn near 40 Proud Boys there. I had never seen a more professionally functioning security force. And back when I used to do this kind of thing with congressmen and senators, and I would work with paid security guys, the Proud Boys outdid all of them. The Proud Boys were so professional and so on point. And they were patrolling, because even though this was private property, it was a three-story strip mall that used to have a lot of restaurants in it. Now there's a pub on the first floor, and then the rest primarily is the banquet and conference rooms. But there was no way to stop people on the street from slinking into the underground garage and maybe harassing people who were parking underground. The Proud Boys were... It was like watching the Secret Service. These guys were so on top of their game that not for a minute did I feel that something could go wrong. I mean,
I was really impressed by them as well, and I think it's definitely worth giving them a shout out and talking about them, because they just I think it was yesterday they'd already been banned from Twitter, but Facebook and Instagram too. So there's this big. Uproar about the Proud Boys. They get it worse than a lot of these more far-right groups like Identity Europa, probably because they're more moderate and therefore more compelling. But, I mean, they're basically treated like a hate group. In one half the time, they'll be described as like a violent hate group. The other half the time, people will kind of make fun of them as this kind of, like, club for, like, lonely white boys or something. But I've been aware of the Proud Boys for a while and been an admirer, a big admirer. But I was even more impressed to kind of see them in person. I mean, a lot of these guys, I don't want to say anything personal about them, but they're very professional in their daily lives and with their organization.
Yeah, I mean, they did an excellent job, and that also touches on an important theme, is the Proud Boys have been censored from social media, and that issue was brought up with Ann Coulter, because censorship on and deplatforming has become a huge issue right now. And the problem is that, I mean, it's a really huge problem, but a lot of conservatives have traditionally taken the issue that free speech is only a government issue, and that corporations should be able to do whatever they want. And I think it's problematic, because traditionally conservatives have been supportive of corporations, even if these corporations want to censor their free speech. So a culture has touched on that. I mean, I would like to see the principles of free speech extended to the private sector, especially these big tech companies. And I think preserving, because basically in the past, the whole issue, and a culture said this, was the kind of town hall or the public square. And now, basically, social media serves that role. So, it should be looked as a freedom of speech issue. And I think the state should get involved with regulating these tech companies, which is conservatives have always said, look, just let capitalism solve the problems. But I do see like that there is a change in the whole political dichotomy, and I think a lot of conservatives are starting to wake up to this issue.
Yeah, and of course, I like to look at it from the left's perspective, because for decades, the left has been like, nationalize everything, man. But it's the stuff that is government-run that has to abide by the First Amendment. The left is getting its way now because everything is becoming private. Now, eventually, a lot of these things are going to come before the Supreme Court. I made the point in a Tacky Mac column several years ago that... A company like Twitter, Facebook, currently they do have the right to engage in what is called viewpoint discrimination. Viewpoint discrimination it's important that we are able to do that. That's what allows Breitbart, Huffington Post.com to say we're not going to employ a left-wing writer, and that's what allows the Huffington Post to say we're not going to employ a right-wing writer.
But there is a fundamental difference between a blog, which is about expressing political opinions, and a platform, which is basically more of a utility. So you're correct under the current law, but my standpoint would be I would like to see the First Amendment extended to the private sector, as far as not so much about blogs and opinions, but more in regards to platforms.
Of course. But also the point, though, that I was building towards is that whereas they can engage in viewpoint discrimination, they can't. And this is why I think current law would be in our favor. They can't engage in racial or identity discrimination. In other words, if they allow a black person to say black is the best and white should be killed, and then a white person says it's okay to be white, I think we're a good race, and they let the black guy say what he said, and they ban the white guy for saying what he said, that is actually not legal. And when I made that point in my column a little less than 2 years ago, I interviewed a couple of lawyers who said it would be great to see a constitutional lawyer take that on, because that would be a place to start. A lot of the discrimination that's going on social media, a lot of it is based on things where if you're a Christian as opposed to a Muslim, if you're white as opposed to black, you're treated differently. Current law covers that. It's just nobody's taken that to court yet. I did recently have an off-the-record discussion with someone at Facebook. There are people at Facebook who are dealing with these issues. I spoke to someone fairly high up. Not everyone at Facebook is a left-wing, censorious, crazy person. And there are people who recognize that Facebook is losing users because of how, I mean, they've just become, it is so easy to ban anyone on the right on Facebook. It is as easy as starting your computer in the morning. It's ridiculously easy. And Facebook doesn't, they're because of their policy of 30-day bans, Twitter will more often than not lock you out until you delete the offensive material. Whereas Facebook will just ban you for 30 days. And all I'll say is there are people at Facebook who realize how this is damaging their market share. Because every time they do one of these 30-day bans or permanently deplatform a person or a group, their market share shrinks. And I think that's another reason why they didn't like Gab. A lot of the people on Gab were people – there are folks at Facebook that kind of wish those people had still stayed on Facebook. They're not the ones in charge. But for every leftist loon at Facebook – there's a bottom line guy, the bottom line guy who's looking at their stock, their market share, and seeing them losing ground to sites like Instagram. One thing, you guys are a lot younger than me. I like to hang out with younger people because I'm still in denial that I'm 50 and I don't want to admit it. I don't want anyone. But one thing I've noticed, these days, every young woman I know, every woman in her 20s, is just on Instagram. Because Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, I mean, they profit through Instagram too, but Instagram is about photos. And the genius of Instagram is today's young person doesn't want to write jack shit. They just want to put their photos on there. But they want people to be able to like it and comment on it. And every young woman I know is just concerned with Instagram. They don't give a damn about Facebook anymore. Some of them are still on Twitter, but for the most part, They're just into Instagram, which I've never been into because I'm a decrepit old man. I don't want pictures of me online. I saw that video when I looked at the video you guys took of me on stage. What a misshapen monster. My God. What I realized from that is next time we do one of these things, I will make it a point to set up a video area front and center, maybe on a riser, because you get me from the side like you did. I mean, Ann Coulter looks beautiful, perfect. She always does. Connor, my assistant, looks debonair, handsome. I come up there, and it's like I'm going to be living under a bridge eating the bones of children. It's horrible. And then when Ann comes and joins me on the stage, and it's the two of us together, you just start singing the Disney theme, Beauty and the Beast. And you know, where's the dancing teapot? Where's the fucking talking grandfather clock? My God, he's a monster. So we got to change the angle for the next one of these we do, because I just look like this horrific Lord of the Rings character who really should just be hiding under the stage and not speaking on it. So we're going to have to work on that, my friend, because I'm telling you this, my chin is not getting any more defined. There's not going to be any working out or cutting out the alcohol or anything like that. So I'm only going to be getting worse. So we got to work on our angle next time.
One more thing that Coulter brought up in the speech that ties in with the whole theme of the economics of censorship is the issue of taxes. So, well, she talked about the kind of a history with Ronald Reagan and how it was a different time back then and how the brackets were different. But she made a good point that whenever Trump goes to rallies, like his biggest applauses are on immigration or the wall. But when he says, let's raise taxes, which usually means on the very top income bracket, he gets a very tepid applause. And that shows an interesting shift in a more kind of a populist direction. Have you noticed that trend?
Of course, because part of it is you get that rhetoric from every Republican. It doesn't matter whether it's Paul Ryan, John McCain, Mitt Romney, or even from the old days, some of the more fiery ones like Jesse Helms or Bob Dornan, William Dannemeyer. You get the same rhetoric. Every Republican, president, congressman, senator, governor, same thing. Lower taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes. And you've been hearing this now your whole life. If you've been in politics, I mean following politics even for 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, 50 years, you've heard it again and again. It has grown dull and also insincere because you've had so many Republican politicians who say the no taxes line like they all do, and then they find a way to raise taxes. So it always gets very tepid applause because we're used to hearing it and we don't always necessarily believe it. Whereas talking about the immigration thing, well, now that's new and fresh, and talking about something that's on a lot of people's minds, especially, well, whether you're in the Southwest and you deal with the immigration issue more, or whether you're in other parts of the country and you don't want to deal with it, you don't want it to eventually come there, you don't want to be like, you know, that poor female jogger that was killed in Iowa, and her dad said something like, yeah, but the immigrants brought great food, great cuisine. They're like white people with better food. That is not how a lot of Americans feel. A lot of Americans are not willing to sacrifice their fucking daughters so they can get an empanada. That's just not on their agenda there. So Trump was giving America something fresh and new, and by saying what he did, it set him apart, because any of those other candidates in that primary would have said low taxes. Ted Cruz would have said low taxes. Marco Rubio would have said low taxes. Even John Kasich would have all said low taxes. We've heard it, boys. We've heard it again and again. I think the public is sick of it. When libertarians talk, and I have anarcho-libertarian friends, libertarian friends, big L, small L libertarian friends, agorist, you know, they have all these names for themselves. When they talk about get rid of government, get rid of taxes, they got to realize we've all grown used to taxes. It doesn't mean we like it. It doesn't mean we like it, but we're now used to it, where we're not going to take up arms because we see a tax increase. Trump tapped into something that resonated because we're not all used to it yet. Most parts of America are still not used to having large Spanish-speaking barrios. So, and those that have them now are not used to them enough yet to necessarily be cool with them.
Matt, what are your kind of ideal hopes, but also realistic predictions for the future of the Republican Party?
That theme really ties into my ultimate take on the event. For as we were talking about earlier, there was a kind of a pre-Trump era, and now we're in the post-Trump era. And this event, this is probably one of the first times I've ever really gotten involved in real life in any political event in this way. And I think you can kind of really see the tipping towards the new direction, towards the kind of stuff that Coulter writes about. It also ties in with the Proud Boys as well. I think there's a big uncertainty right now among mainstream conservatives, I think largely mainstream conservatives kind of will reject the Proud Boys because they've been labeled a hate group. But then you have other people like Ann Coulter, of course, who is extremely laudatory of them. Tucker Carlson has posed in pictures of Proud Boys. There's this kind of uncertainty where you have some mainstream conservatives and Republicans who are advocating them.
And, I mean, it's really remarkable, too, for that shift, because Fox News used to be full-on neoconservative, neocon, and now Tucker Carlson's on there, and he's almost, like, borderline alt-right.
Yeah, he's, like, alt-light. And I do think, not the alt-right, but I do think the alt-light, as exemplified by people like Coulter and groups like the Proud Boys, I do think that is the future of the Republican Party. I think that's where the energy is. Obviously, there's this strong neocon element, which is still has a degree of power, but when the youth is so much, the energy in the youth is so much on one side, it's hard to imagine it going back towards a more neocon direction. But the other part of the point to make is that I think we're in a really good position right now, we being, you know, right-wingers of various stripes, because the left has forfeited, first of all, they forfeited freedom of speech, and now all the kind of energy is on the other side, and a lot of the most interesting expressions, creative or otherwise, are coming from the right side. And I think that will have a huge role kind of going forward in terms of the political currents of the country.
And David, before I wrap up this show, do you want to talk about your plans for the future?
Well, we keep it going. Friends of Abe was dissolved in early 2016 against the wishes of all the members. It was dissolved because the guy running it at that time was a never-Trumper. But the people are still here. The group might not be here anymore. The people are here, and I plan on continuing to provide events for them every couple of months for as long as they want it.
David Cole, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Always a great pleasure, guys. Always thank you very much for having me on.